Hi, everybody. Welcome to the physics lecture, Physics 113 lecture for October 1st, 2013. I hope that your preparations for the exam are going well, or more than likely that the exam itself went well for you last Thursday. Make yourself comfortable. So here we go. I needed to note for you that as I was getting ready to go to Japan, I noticed that what I needed to give a lecture on today for you really was something I had already made electronic versions of lectures for earlier. So what I'm providing for you right now is actually a concatenation of the end of one lecture and another lecture that I prepared last year. So what that means in practice is that there will be a little awkwardness. We're going to start with the slides, basically an intro slide, and then it's going to jump to slide 14, which will give an example of a mass sliding on a table and another mass hanging. We'll go to slides 15, 16, and then at that point we're going to move to slide 2, which will be next in order in the slides I give you, and we will continue on in order up through, I think it looks like slide 17. So what this means, in part because I want it to match the audio, we're going to have sort of double valued page numbers here, and for 14, 15, 16. So anyway, my apologies for that, but I hope it won't seem too awkward. It just seems an efficient thing to do. So with all of that, I will go ahead and start covering the material I want to cover. So see you soon. Bye.
So let's look on slide 14 and do an example problem. Suppose we have a mass M1 sitting on the surface of a table, and we have mass M2 hanging from a rope or a string that passes over the pulley and is attached to mass 1. And let's say that the system, we've let it go, but it's still sitting there at rest. And it's sitting there at rest because there's a force of friction between M1 and the table, which is basically keeping M1 from sliding. For particulars, let's let M2 equal 20 kilograms and M1 equal 10 kilograms. And the problem is, what you're asked for is to determine the smallest mu sub s, the coefficient of static friction between the surface of the table and M1, that can lead to this physical situation where we've let it go and it's not moving. The wording, determine the smallest mu sub s, is the thing that's telling you that that you're at a limiting case, that you can use force of static friction equal to mu sub s n when you do this problem. So let's go to slide 15. Let's look at the free body diagram on mass 2. If we define plus y to be up for mass 2, which means we should define it to be to the left for mass 1 on the table. But again, on slide 15, we're only worrying about mass 2. The tension is positive going up, and the gravitational force, M2g, is negative going down. Excuse me. The sum of the forces is equal to mass 2 times the acceleration of mass 2 in the y. But that's zero because the thing's not moving by definition. So zero is equal to the tension minus M2g, or the tension is equal to M2g. Let's go to slide 16. On slide 16, we're looking at the free body diagram for mass 1, where I have a green A in a circle. So for mass 1, it's sitting on the table, so we have M1g down. We have the normal force up. I'm going to call the up direction the positive x direction. We have the force of friction to the left because the tension is pulling the mass to the right. The tension is a real force of the string pulling on this object, but the object's not moving along that axis. So we know that the sum of the forces has to be zero. What's the only other force you can have would be the force of friction, which is opposing what would be the motion. I've defined plus y to go to the left because that is consistent with the plus y for mass 2 going up. That is, if mass 2 goes up an inch, mass 1 goes to the left an inch. Or if mass 2 goes down 2 inches, mass 1 on the table goes to the right 2 inches. So, let's look where I have a green C. For the axis perpendicular to the table, the sum of the forces is equal to m1 times the acceleration of the mass in the up and down direction perpendicular to the table. I know that's zero because it's not crashing through the table. So that's equal to n minus m1g. So I know that the normal force is equal to m1g. If we look where I have a green B in a circle, which is the direction, let's look at the direction parallel to the table. The sum of the forces in the y is equal to m1 times a in the y. That's zero because I know it's not moving by definition in this problem. And that will be the force of the friction moving to the left, which is positive, minus the tension moving to the right, which is negative. So 0 is equal to the force of friction minus T, so I know the tension is equal to the force of friction. By definition, this force of friction at the limiting case, if I want to know the smallest mu sub s I could have, so if we say that that force of friction is as large as it can be for the mu sub s that I have, then I can define that force of friction as mu sub s times n. And that is equal to T, as I show in the yellow box where I have a little d in a green circle. I now want to substitute in for what I found to be the normal force, which is m1g, and what I found to be the tension from the last page, which is m2g. So if I go where I have a green E in a circle, we have mu sub s times m1g is equal to m2g, and now the g's cancel, and I can solve for the mu sub s in this problem. Mu sub s is equal to m2 over m1. That's where I have the green F in the circle, or the red box. How about units? Well, mu sub s is just a number. It's a proportionality constant. So it's unitless. And m2 over m1 is unitless, so that's good. And that's pretty much all you can really check here. So that is the answer to our problem.
Okay, now for the awkward slide transition, I want you to go from slide 16 to what would then be numbered slide 2. And then we'll have pictures of masses on surfaces and a ladder to the right.
So last time we talked about the force that occurs between two surfaces that are in contact. That force, you can think of one surface pressing on the other. The force is at right angles to where the surfaces contact one another. It's perpendicular to the plane of contact. And notice the symbol that I use to signify perpendicular, which is up above the green A in a circle. I've drawn three sketches on slide 2. The left-hand most, where the green A is in the circle, we have a block on a surface like a table or a floor. And in that case, the surface exerts a force on the block that is straight up, perpendicular to where the two surfaces contact one another. In the middle diagram, where I have a B in a green circle, you can see the block on an inclined plane. And now the surface exerts a force, and that force, again, is at right angles to where those two surfaces contact one another. So you can see that the normal force will act at an angle as the plane of contact between two surfaces changes. In slide C, I have drawn a ladder leaning up against the wall, so it is in contact with surfaces both at the bottom and at the top, and there are two normal forces, and each of those normal forces are at right angles to where the two surfaces contact one another. So these are examples of normal forces, and when you read the problems, often the normal force will not be called out specifically, so you'll have to infer the existence of the normal force. And if you don't, then you're going to get the problem wrong, because the normal force is actually there. But it's not usually an external force that is brought into the problem, so it's not usually spelled out. So just get used to this. Always ask yourself in the midst of a problem, you know, do I need to be dealing with some normal force here that maybe I haven't put into the problem? Okay, so let's go to slide 3. And because we have two surfaces contacting each other when we have a normal force, you can imagine there will be a frictional force between the two surfaces if you were to try to slide one over the other. You can assume that this is the case unless you are told otherwise. Generally, the problem will be spelled out fairly specifically. The block is sliding on a frictionless inclined plane, or the block slides on a surface with no friction, etc. So generally, in problems when you need to neglect friction, you'll be told. During an exam, if you want to confirm with me whether or not friction has a role to play when you read the problem, you're welcome to ask. So it turns out that there are two types of friction we need to consider, and I think you'll find this actually fairly intuitive. Imagine trying to slide a big box of books on the floor. When you first put effort behind sliding the books, they don't really want to move, and you have to put a big effort into getting it to move. Once those books begin to move, you still have to put effort into pushing the books in order to keep them moving, but you're now putting less effort into it. So when two surfaces are in a static situation, when they are at rest with respect to one another and there's a normal force between them, they stick together fairly well. And then when you force them to begin to move with respect to one another, they also will stick together, but they will not stick together as much as they do when they are at rest with respect to one another. So we will consider two different cases where friction is concerned. And please understand that in the real world, where engineers deal with things, and, you know, let's suppose you're an engineer working in a car factory, you might understand that there are many more subtleties with friction, and you may put a career into learning about friction and changing some aspect of the amount of friction in a car engine, and thereby save, you know, a billion gallons of gasoline or something. And this may be a great thing. So what we're learning is a simplification, and we're only going to consider two basic categories. So the first category, as listed on slide 3, is called kinetic friction, and this is the friction between sliding surfaces. So you imagine where we have a green A in a circle, we have a block that is moving with some velocity on a surface. The force of friction opposes that motion, and we quantify the force of friction according to the equation on the right-hand side of slide 3. Force of friction is equal to mu sub k times the normal force. It makes sense that the degree of friction depends on how hard the two forces press against one another, which is what we mean when we talk about the normal force. And then we have to have this constant, mu sub k, which is the coefficient of kinetic friction, and that really quantifies the nature of the contact between the two surfaces. Things that are sticky or sandpaper-like will have a larger mu sub k than things that are slide easily with respect to one another but still have friction. Let's go to slide 4. The second case that we have to deal with friction is called static friction, and this happens to be the case where we have two surfaces that are not moving with respect to one another. So imagine we have the situation as shown, where we have a green A in a circle, where we have a block sitting on a surface, and the velocity of this block is zero, okay? It's not moving. Yet, there's still someone pulling on this block with a rope, so a force is being exerted on this block, but it's not going anywhere. The acceleration is zero, the velocity is zero. We know that there must be another force which is balancing the force, the tension in the rope, which is pulling on the block. Okay? And that force is the force of friction, which will pull the other way. And please note that if you only pull lightly on that block and it's not moving, the force of friction that opposes that force, the force with which you're pulling, only has to be big enough to counterbalance the force you're pulling with. As the force you're pulling with grows, that force of friction, if the block is not to move, has to grow. Again, it's sort of a reaction force. It's equal and opposite to the force you're pulling with. There's a limiting case. When you pull really, really hard, there is a limiting case where finally this block begins to move. The limiting case, that is the largest the friction value can be before it begins to move, is what we normally quantify. And we quantify it with the equation listed as the limiting condition just below where we have the B in a green circle. The force of friction at the limit is equal to mu sub s times n. Just up above that is an equation where we say the force of friction is less than or equal to mu sub s times n. Again, the harder the surfaces press against one another, the larger is n, which is why you have n on the right-hand side, the magnitude of the normal force. In addition to that, we now have this constant, which in this case we call it the coefficient of static friction because the surfaces are not moving with respect to one another. And this constant really quantifies the nature of the two forces, the two surfaces that are sliding with respect to one another, whether they stick together easily or they really are smooth or something. Generally speaking, often when you see problems that involve static friction, you will be operating at the limiting case. Not always, so you have to keep your eyes open for it. But when you are operating at this limiting condition so that the equation that frictional force is equal to mu sub s times n, that limiting condition will tend to be flagged with the wording in the problem. You know, what is the smallest mu sub s that does so and so? Or at what inclined plane angle will the box just begin to slip given mu sub s? So what that means is that you have a given mu sub s, the box is not moving, it's sitting on an inclined plane, and you slowly increase the angle of the inclined plane, and at some particular angle, all of a sudden, the downward force on the box overcomes this maximal force of static friction, and the box will begin to move. So you'll see problems with this careful sort of wording. And so if the wording seems a little bit awkward, I want you to look at it and see if you think that it means that you're really fretting about a case where you're at this limiting value of static friction. Whenever you have friction in a Newton's law problem, you must take it into account. And again, sometimes the problem will not call it out specifically, so you'll have to infer its existence. Unless you're told otherwise, such as it's a frictionless inclined plane, you assume that there's friction there. Let's go to slide 5. Okay, I want to change gears a little bit. It's football season these days, so let's think about football. Let's imagine that we're in Hoyt and that I'm doing a demonstration of projectile motion. So we're in Hoyt and I can throw a football in a projectile a long path like a normal projectile would take, and it flies a little ways across Hoyt and hits the floor. Okay. Then let's suppose that we go outside and I haul off and I throw it a good bit harder. And so what would happen? Well, the ball goes higher, and because it's in the air longer, it goes farther. And again, you'll see sort of the standard parabolic projectile path that you're used to seeing. So let's then, and so if we were to look from the side of the Earth, and this is exaggerated, of course, you could imagine seeing the path of the ball as shown as the little blue thing on the figure where I have B in a circle. So let's suppose I haul off and throw it even harder. Then you might see something like C. If I throw it even harder, you might see something like D. And if I can really haul off and throw that ball hard enough, then I can throw it so hard that as it falls in its projectile toward the earth actually curves away. And if I throw it hard enough, the falling of the ball around the earth goes along in the same way the curvature of the earth goes, and the ball will literally fall all the way around the earth and come back and hit me in the head. And that is what we call an orbit. It is also an example of circular motion. Interestingly enough, the ball is not in... So when you have something in orbit, like a spaceship, you know, people up in the space station or something, it is not the case that they are weightless. In fact, they are constantly attracted toward the center of the Earth. If they weren't, they would go in a straight line because of Newton's first law. A body in motion continues in motion, persists in that motion, unless acted on by a force. If we turned the gravitational force of Earth off, the space station would go in a straight line and would leave the solar system eventually. But the reason that it doesn't is because it is attracted toward the center of the Earth constantly. In other words, it is in constant free fall. It is falling around the Earth in such a way that it basically looks like the path that we have in the upper right-hand corner sketch on figure 5. That's what we mean when we talk about an orbit. And so you can get circular motion if you have a constant force toward the center of the circle that constantly accelerates the particle, that is, changes its velocity, the angle of it, as it goes around, such that it comes back and closes the circle. So let's look at that more carefully. At the bottom of slide 5, I want you to recall what we know about circular motion. If we have a circle with radius r, you can imagine a thin slice of pie with an angular opening of delta theta. And if we look at the outside edge of that pie and measure the linear length, the arc length along that slice of pie, let's call it delta s. And where we have F in a green circle, there's a relationship between that arc length, the opening angle, and the radius. And that relationship is given in black. Delta S is equal to R times delta theta, where delta theta now is the angle of that pi opening in radians. So I hope this is familiar to you. Let us go to slide 6. So if we have an object that is moving on a circle of radius r, such as we have where I have a green A in a circle, you can imagine a particle that has a velocity vector v1, and it's moving in a circle. So it moves a linear distance, delta s, and in that time, the velocity vector v1 changes direction to where it becomes the velocity vector v2. Let us assume that the magnitude of v1 is equal to the magnitude of v2, which we'll just call v. So we're not losing speed as we go around this circle, but the direction of the velocity vector is changing, and it's changing at a constant rate. So you can imagine thinking of a change in the velocity vector, that is, v2 minus v1 equal to delta v. And let's look where we have the green B in a circle. These two vectors, v1 and v2, we can look at the difference between them, and we can get a vector delta b. Or if you want to say v1 plus delta v is equal to v2. The This delta V is basically a vector that cuts directly from the head of V1 to the head of V2, but it is very similar to the arc length in terms of its magnitude if you look at the geometry. So you have a situation sort of like I have where we have the C in a green circle, where for a large enough circle, the chord which cuts from the left-hand corner to the right-hand corner up near the arc length is very similar in length to the arc length. So we can imagine that delta V and the magnitudes of the two V's have a relationship which is similar to delta S is equal to R delta theta, where I have the green D in a circle. So we now think of this sort of pie-shaped triangle with the sides V1, V2, and delta V as sort of the outer edge. We can imagine it being it will be geometrically similar to the triangle we get when we look at the sketch in figure A, where we have sides of radius R with a delta theta opening and delta S as the arc length. In fact, you can even imagine, since the velocity vectors are always tangent to the radius, as the radius goes around the circle, you are sweeping the velocity vectors. And if you think about it that way, then probably the connection that I'm trying to draw, where D is in a green circle, may make sense to you. I hope so. At any rate, because of the similarity of these triangles, we can write, where we have the D in a green circle, that this delta V, this change in the velocity vector, is equal to V times delta theta, where it's the same delta theta we've swept out in the sketch on the upper left-hand side. So if I divide both sides by time, the amount of time it takes to go from position 1 to position 2, we get the equation where I've circled a green E on the lower left-hand side. Delta V over delta T is equal to V times delta theta over delta T. But what is delta theta? Delta theta is delta S over R, so I substitute in for that, and we find that delta V over delta T is equal to V over R times delta S over delta T. And that's where we have the green F in the circle. If we go to slide 7 now, if we look at this equation that we have in slide 6 at the bottom, and we look at it in the limit of small delta T, then these quantities with finite differences delta become derivatives. And so we have the equation on slide 7, which where I have the A in a green circle, that dV over dt is equal to V over R times basically dS over dt, which is V. It's the linear velocity around the circle. dV over dt, remember, is an acceleration. And this is the acceleration on the circle. You say that V isn't changing. Well, the magnitude of V isn't changing, but the direction is. So in the end, what we have is a relationship between the acceleration of the mass toward the center of the circle, which is the left-hand side, and we call that acceleration the centripetal acceleration. It is nothing but an acceleration, but it is constant in magnitude and it is always toward the center of the circle. So the relationship is between the centripetal acceleration on the left-hand side and the linear velocity around the edge of the circle on the right-hand side, which it gives us V squared over R. So where we have equation, so all of this derivation leads to the equation that I have labeled on the lower, by a green C in a circle, on the lower left-hand side of slide 7. The centripetal acceleration magnitude is equal to mv squared over r, where it's the mass times the magnitude squared of the velocity over r. If you have motion on a circle, then this equation is true. If you have this equation being satisfied in any situation, you then know that the motion is a circle. Okay? So whenever you see a circle, you need to think to yourself, The acceleration toward the center is mv squared over r. And if I tell you something is mv squared over r, it's the force toward the center, then you know, it's moving on a circle. Okay, so you really need to get good at that. So the situation we have really is described where we have lower right-hand side of slide 7, where I have a sketch beside the green B in a circle. If I have a mass moving in a circle, it will have a tangential velocity at any given moment and an acceleration, A sub C, which is toward the center. We call that the centripetal acceleration. That acceleration is in the radial direction toward the center of the circle. And as the mass moves around the circle, these vectors change direction so that V is always tangent to the circle and A sub C is always toward the center. Let's go to slide 8. What I'd like to do now is an example. Let's suppose, what I'd like to do is calculate the speed of the space shuttle when it is in an orbit at a height of 100 kilometers. So we have the situation given in the little sketch where I have a green A in a circle, where the shuttle is flying at a height of 100 kilometers over the surface of the Earth, and let us assume that it is moving in a circular orbit. At this height, it's actually a relatively small height compared to the distance to the center of the Earth, so we can assume that the acceleration due to gravity at this height is 9.8 meters per second squared. That is the same as it is on the surface of the Earth. It will be slightly different, but we don't have to worry about that. Once we say the shuttle moves on a circle, then we know that the equation where I have B in a green circle holds true. The acceleration toward the center is V squared over R. So we go to where I have a C in a green circle. The acceleration toward the center is 9.8 meters per second squared. That's equal to V squared, right? You know, I have a mistake. I apologize. I want you to go back to slide 7. And I want you to understand that the centripetal acceleration is V squared over R with no M. The centripetal force is equal to mv squared over r. And I'm going to write that where I have a green D in a circle on slide 7. I'm sorry for the mistake. I just blitzed out there. Right. So the centripetal acceleration, that's acceleration toward the center, is equal to V squared over R. You multiply that by the mass, and you get the centripetal force, that is the force toward the center, which is mv squared over R. So, sorry to misspeak a moment ago. I'm really toying with the idea whether I need to go back and redo that part of the lecture, but it's a little bit hard to do since I'm recording the lecture. So I'm hoping that this now makes sense for you. So that's on slide 7. If we go to slide 8, what I'm calculating, where we have C in a green circle, is the centripetal acceleration. So the equation we want to use is the equation on slide 7, where we have the green C in a circle, where A sub C is equal to V squared over R. The M I've now crossed out in an orange X, and I'm sure that'll be a bit confusing to you since I didn't have it that way earlier in the lecture when I was speaking. Sorry about that. So now on slide 8, we have this centripetal acceleration, 9.8 meters per second squared, is equal to d squared over r. What is r? R is equal to the radius of the Earth, which is 6.37 times 10 to the 6 meters, plus the 100 kilometers, which is the height of the shell above the surface of the Earth. So we substitute in for the radius of the Earth and calculate v's. And we get that V is 7,960 meters per second, or 17,812 miles per hour. So, to summarize circular motion, imagine that we have a mass moving around a circle. So, on slide 9, we have a mass moving around a circle with a tangential velocity, V, at all points. There will constantly be a centripetal acceleration or a centripetal force, which is in the radial direction pointing toward the center of the circle. The centripetal acceleration is equal to the magnitude of v squared over r, and the centripetal force is the mass times that, or ma sub c, or mv squared over r. If you have a circle, these equations are true. If these equations are true, you have a circle. Let's go to slide 10. Let's do another example. Suppose we have a car which is being driven at 20 kilometers per hour in a circle of radius 50 meters on a flat parking lot. What is the minimum coefficient of static friction required to keep the car on the circle? I say keep the car on the road, but let's just say keep it on the circle. So, sort of the front view of what's going on, you can see in where I have a green A in a circle, the car has a normal force on it, the force of the ground on the tires. From above, you can see where I have a green B in a circle, the car moves with a tangential velocity of 20 kilometers per hour around the circle of radius big R. There will be a centripetal force toward the center, which is mv squared over R. If we look where I have a green C in a circle, the relevant axes for this type of circular problem really are the tangential and the radial axes, or the perpendicular axis. So I'd like to define the radial direction to be positive toward the center and the tangential direction to be positive going in the direction the car is going in any given moment, which you need to understand is very odd compared to what we've seen in the past. These axes now move with the car. As the car moves around the circle, so it's in a position where I have the green D in the circle, the axes would look like I've drawn in blue there. So they rotate around the circle along with the car. So if we go to slide 11, the first thing we need to do is to convert the 20 kilometers per hour into meters per second so we can deal with the MKS system of units. I'm going to use the factor label method, which is something I hope you all have gotten very used to doing with chemistry. So 20 kilometers an hour, I multiply by 1,000 meters per kilometer, and that cancels out the kilometer unit. And then I multiply that by 1 hour over 60 minutes, and that cancels out the hour unit and leaves me in meters per minute. So I multiply by 1 over 60 seconds to get rid of the minutes unit, and I'm left with meters per second. So 20 kilometers per hour is equal to 5.5 meters per second. So if I now look from the front of the car, where I have a green B in a circle, the forces that are on the car are we have the gravitational force down, the normal force up, and the frictional force to the side toward the center of the circle. So I want to sum forces, and there are no forces tangential along the circle. So these are the two axes we need to deal with, the up and down and the radial direction. So We do Newton's second law, where I have C, green C in a circle in the up and down direction. I have the normal force is up, and I have the weight of the car, mg, is down. The car does not crash through the parking lot, and it doesn't go flying into the air, so I know that there is no acceleration in this up and down y direction. So the sum of the forces in the y is equal to zero, which is equal to the mass times the acceleration in the y. So I know, and this is equal to n minus mg if I've defined y as positive upward. So n is equal to mg because the sum of these forces is zero. So that tells us the size of the normal force. In the radial direction, I know that there is a net unbalanced force because this car is constantly accelerating toward the center. So I know the acceleration is not zero. In fact, because it's moving on a circle, I know that the force toward the center has to be equal to mv squared over r. The only force that I have toward the center is the frictional force, so I can set mv squared over r equal to mu sub s times n. This is where I have a green d in a circle. But I've already solved for n, that's equal to mg, so I can substitute for n, and I have that mv squared over r is equal to mu sub s times mg. The m's cancel, and I can now solve for the mu sub s. Mu sub s is equal to v squared over rg. So let's look at the units. Mu sub s is just a constant quantifying how much the two surfaces stick together. So that has to be unitless. At the bottom, we have r in meters and g in meters per second squared. So we have meters squared per second squared on the bottom. On the top, we have meters per second, quantity squared. So the units all cancel. So the units where I have a green e in the circle and that equation in the red box, everything cancels. So that's good. Now let's see if it makes physical sense. If I am taking this car and I'm going around the circle and I go really, really, really fast, then we know that we need more friction to hold us on the road, to keep us in the same circle. So mu sub s would have to be bigger if I could have a larger velocity. If I go to a large radius, that is a circle with a smaller radius, with a larger radius curvature, then it will take less friction to hold us on that circle, or less of a force toward the center in order to bend us, because we're bending less quickly. So a smaller mu sub s is okay, and that makes sense because in the equation in the red box, if r gets big, then mu sub s gets small. So all of this makes physical sense, and you can all relax. I think we got the right answer here. So that is circular motion, and we'll do lots of problems with it. You'll get used to it. It's a very useful thing to know. So now I want to change gears, and on slide 12, I want to begin talking about work and energy in physics. So what is work? I mean, it's sort of a strange concept. I remember when my kids were little once, I was leaving one morning for work, and so I said, bye, and one of my kids said, where are you going? I said, I'm going to work. And they said, wait. They were just little things. So I waited by the door for a minute. And then my daughter came up to me, my son bumbling along behind her. And they handed me their box of colored markers and crayons. And I said, well, thank you, but why are you handing me all your markers? And my daughter says, because you're going to work. And I said, well, yeah. And she says, and that's where you make money. So apparently the thought process was that if I were going to go to work and make money, clearly I needed to have the markers so that I could make the money and color the money. So I was very touched, of course, that my children thought that I was a counterfeiter. But it brings home the fact that the whole concept of work is sort of oddly confusing. I mean, it's a word that gets used in many different ways in the English language. And even in science, work is a word that gets used in a different way. I mean, I would argue that biological work is sort of different from what we mean when we talk about work in physics. If you are holding, if you're standing still and you're holding a really heavy object, you're exerting a tremendous amount of effort to keep that object from crashing onto your feet. And one might argue you're doing biological work. But oddly enough, you are not doing work in the world of physics, because in order to do work in the world of physics, you have to exert a force through a specific distance. So we define work, and this is this one deserves a little bit of caveats. Work is equal to force times distance in physics. It's a little more complicated than that, and we'll come into that complication in a minute. But basically, it's force through a distance, okay? That's what we mean by work. Energy in physics, the best definition that I know of for energy is it's the ability to do work, which again may sound like sort of a useless definition, but it turns out to work, very well. So work, energy can take many different forms, and it isn't obvious how to connect energy in some of its different forms with work or the ability to do work. But the kinds of forms energy can take that we'll see: kinetic energy, which is really energy of motion, energy, heat energy, light energy, sound energy, mechanical energy of different sorts. There's also energy. Einstein became very famous and launched the nuclear age when he realized that mass is actually a form of energy. Remember his famous equation, equals mc squared. I mean, that's basically what it tells you. So let's go to slide 13. Energy also can be in a potential form. So we say we have potential energy if we have the potential to do work. So for example, let's suppose where I have a green A in a circle, I take a mass and I compress it up against a spring. If I let that go, that mass can go flying and push on something and exert a force through a distance. So that coiled spring configuration has within it energy, which is stored because it has within it the ability to do work. A number where I have a B in a green circle, you can have a situation where because I have lifted a mass up to the top of this high wall, it has the ability to do work. If I shove that mass over the wall, it can do work. It can go to the bottom and exert a force through a distance, you know, and squash this bug, for example, and that actually is a form of work. So energy and work are all tied together, and in fact, in physics, you can think of energy and work as basically being one and the same in terms of if you have one, you can convert it to the other. So they have to have the same units. In an MKS system, the unit of energy or work that we use is called the joule. 1 joule is equal to 1 newton meter. That is, 1 joule is equal to the work it takes to exert a force on something through a distance of 1 meter, where that force is 1 newton. So 1 newton meter is equal to 1 kilogram per times meter per second squared times meter. So in terms of basic units, 1 joule is equal to 1 kilogram meter squared per second squared. Let's go to slide 14. Now the subtlety I promised you a little while ago is that work isn't just force times distance. It is force times the distance moved along the direction of that force. Or work is the magnitude of the force component, which is along the direction of movement, times the distance moved. In other words, for work in physics, we use a form of vector multiplication that projects out the component of one vector along the other, and that is the only relevant piece that's important. The other thing to note is that work is a number, it's an amount, whereas it is made up of these two things, which are vectors, force and displacement. So we have to be able to multiply these two vectors and end up with a scalar. And in that multiplication, we only multiply the component of one of those vectors, which is along the other vector. And the piece that's perpendicular doesn't come into the multiplication. So this may seem a little bit strange, but let me try to elucidate it a little bit. If you are a waiter and you're walking along holding a serving platter with a meal on top of the serving platter, and you're keeping it at exactly the same height as you walk, clearly you're doing biological work in the sense that it takes effort to hold this stupid platter up. Okay, you'll be tired at the end of the day. But in terms of physics, your work is zero. Why? To hold the platter up, there's a force of gravity on the platter down. The force you exert in order to hold it up is straight up. Okay, your movement is sideways. So your displacement is at right angles to the force that you're exerting. Therefore, you do not do any work where physics is concerned because there's no component of one of those vectors along the other. If, on the other hand, you are lifting the platter up from a table, you know, and lifting it up above your head, you're now exerting a force along the direction of the movement. And now you will have a non-zero work according to physics. Okay, so I hope that helps paint the difference a little bit, and or at least paint how physics looks at this. So let's go to slide 15. We have to develop the mathematics that we need to describe work, because remember, we have to do this special multiplication between two vectors, and it has to project out only that particular component. It turns out there's a very particular type of multiplication that we use, and that is called the dot product or the scalar product. And this is now general. It's not confined to work. The dot product or the scalar product is just a form of multiplication in vector calculus, vector physics, in vector mathematics. Okay. So imagine on slide 15 on the upper left-hand side where I have a green A in a circle. Suppose I have two vectors, A and B, and they lie in the plane of the board. Okay, so there's an opening angle between them, which I'll call theta. We define the dot product where I have D in a green circle as A dot B. And that's equal to the magnitude of A times the magnitude of B times the cosine of the angle between them. And this is a scalar. Okay, it's not a vector. I've taken the magnitudes. I've dropped the direction, and I just have three things that are magnitudes and multiply them by each other. To see what this is doing, I want you to look at the two cases on the lower left-hand side where I have the same situation with A and B and the angle between them. But now what I want to show you is that imagine where I have the green B in a circle, I have A and B the way they are. Let's look at the projection of A along B. So I've drawn the projection of A along B, and that's going to be the magnitude of A times cosine theta. Similarly, if I look where I have the green C, let's look at the projection of B along A, and you can see that it's B cosine theta. So it doesn't really matter whether I want to multiply these two things, taking the projection of A along B or the projection of B along A. Either way, I end up with the equation A times B times cosine theta, like I have where I have the green D in a circle. It doesn't matter which of these vectors I take first, so A dot B is equal to B dot A. Let's go to slide 16. There is another useful formula to know about this dot product, and that's given where I have a pink A in a circle. A dot B is equal to the component of A in the X times the component of B in the X plus the component of A in the Y times the component of B in the Y plus the component of A in the Z times the component of B in the Z. This may seem sort of painful, but it turns out this is also a very useful form for calculating the dot product at times. I'm not going to do vector proofs for you in any exams or anything, but I want to do this one here so this equation makes sense for you. A dot B is, by definition, where I have the green B the pink B in the circle. A dot B can be rewritten in terms of the components of A dotted into the components of B, as you see where I have the pink B in the circle. I've now divided it up into components along the I, J, and K directions, that is the X, Y, and Z axes, right? And remember what a unit vector is. A unit vector is something that has a magnitude of 1, and it just gives you an indication of direction. So I now want to distribute the terms. So the A sub X times I hat gets multiplied by each of the three B terms on the upper line where I have the pink C in the circle. Similarly, the Y component of A times J hat gets distributed among the three B terms in the middle line where I have this pink C in a circle. And the Z component of A times K hat gets distributed among the three B terms where I have, on the third line, where I have the pink C in a circle. The dot products don't disappear. They just get distributed in the same way that you would normal mathematical algebra sort of stuff. So the first term, for example, is AX times I hat dotted into BX times I hat. The AX and the BX pull out of the dot product. They're just numbers, and I have I hat dot I hat. Well, that's one vector dotted into another vector, into the same vector, so the angle between them is 0. Cosine theta of 0 is just 1. So that has the magnitude of I hat, which is 1, times the magnitude of I hat, which is 1, times cosine, the angle between them, which is 1. So that whole term, the first term in this 9-term expansion where I have the C in a pink circle, is just AX times BX. Similarly, that holds true for the AY times BY term and the AZ times BZ term. But the other terms, for example, where I have AX times BY, I have an I hat dotted into a J hat. Now those two unit vectors are at right angles to one another, and the cosine of 90 degrees is 0, or there is no component of the I hat along the J hat. So all of these terms where the two unit vectors are different, and I have orange marker marked through it, those are all equal to 0. So that leaves only the three terms, AX times BX plus AY times BY plus AZ times BZ, and you get the equation that we have where I have the F in a circle. You'll find this equation can be very useful in calculating dot products, which is something you'll have to do a lot of. And this formula is true in addition to the one that I gave you sort of as a defining expression earlier, where I have the G in a circle. Okay, so let's go to slide 17. Okay, so that's fine and nice, but why do you really care about this dot crap? Well, it's because remember that work is force times displacement, but it's not just force times displacement. It's force times displacement where we multiply the projection of one of the vectors along the other with the magnitude of the other. In other words, it is precisely what you mean when you talk about a dot product. So work, which is force times distance, is really the vector force dotted into the vector distance, or displacement, if you will. So like what I have drawn in a green A in a circle. So you can imagine having a case where I have sketched, where I have a green B in a circle, where I have a particle that is moving on some path as a function of time, and that path is described by the vector S as a function of T, okay? And we may have, that particle may undergo a force, and that force may change with time. I've drawn it at two different times, T1 and T2, for example, in pink. So you can imagine now having this particle moving sort of in arbitrary space, and there are forces that are on it as a function of time, and it has this basic path. So we'd like to be able to compute how much work is done on this particle due to the force as it goes from, say, its start of its path to the end of the path. That, of course, is a very complicated problem because this projection of one vector on the other, they may be changing in magnitude, they may be changing in direction, so it becomes very hard. So what we want to do instead is to actually consider this motion only under a differential amount of time. And in a differential amount of time, the particle will only go a differential distance, which I'll call ds vector. And I have tried to sketch a very small portion of the vector of the particle's motion where I have a green C in a circle. So imagine blowing up some little piece of the path of the particle so that we have the sketch on the lower left-hand side of slide 17. So for a very little bit of time, the particle moves only a very little distance, which I'll quantify as this ds vector. During that time, because it's such a short time, you can consider the force to be constant, and I will call it F at that point. So the amount of work done over this little tiny interval is a differential amount of work because we're only considering over a differential little amount of time. So that dw is equal to that force, F, dotted into the vector ds. So if I now want to ask, what is the total work done from start to end of this particle's path, I basically want to sum up all the little differential works of these little elements along the path. And that is what I mean when I say that I want to do an integral. So D is the actual formal definition of the work from the start to the end of the path. It's the integral of the force dotted into ds over the entire path. So this is the formal definition of work. I mean, it could be that we'll end up having to use this now and then, but generally it boils down to being a bit easier than this. You'll do problems where the path is not usually so complicated, and the integral really boils down along into several different finite pieces. For example, you carry a bowling ball up a cliff. You then move sideways, and then you carry the ball down the cliff. Okay, you really have three elements of the path. In the first element, you have a normal force that you're exerting on the ball, and you're going up the cliff, so you do work on the ball to get it up the cliff, but the actual calculation is the normal force times the height that you move it. So the integral piece isn't complicated there, it's just a multiplication. Then you go sideways, and at that point, it's similar to the waiter holding the platter. You're exerting a normal force, but the distance you're moving is sideways, so that contribution to the integral is zero. And then when you're going down, it's similar to what you did in the first place, except the vector, the force that you're exerting is now in opposite directions from the distance you go, so it comes in with a minus sign. And yes, you can have things like negative work. It's just a shame we can't do that in real life. But at any rate, we're going to come back and do example problems with work next time. And I hope you're having a good week, and this is the end of the September 27th lecture. Bye.